If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTRadio.live. Welcome to the Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is Dirk Pohlman, and my guest is Alina Lipp, and she just informed me that she has to dash off to an assignment. So the second hour is not with Alina Lipp. I will talk about us, about how we got to know each other. And we met for one time on Crimea. I will talk a little bit about that. So, Alina, thank you very much for the talk up to now. And good luck with your reporting. You go on. Please, you go on doing what you are right now. You are you're on the way of becoming a real interesting, important journalist, because you are there as a very young woman in the midst of the fighting in Donbas, and you're doing what most of these the network colleagues do not do. There's this quite famous story from one of the German journalists who'd been there, and he was noticed that he was driven out with his colleagues from a hotel to an area where there were wrecks, burned out wrecks, and each of the journalists had a canister with gasoline with them. And then when they arrived at the scene, they were putting the gasoline on the wrecks, they set them afire, and then they started to do fake live reporting from the war in Iraq. And he wrote that home, and he stumbled through the picture because he didn't know what was going on. And his mother later saw him on German news and said, "Oh, I'm so glad you survived. You were in the middle of this fighting." And he told her the story, and she couldn't believe it. What you do is different. You're pulled aside by a cameraman because you ran into his picture, and this Danish so-called journalist makes the story out of it that you were put aside because you were controlled by these people, when it was the usual case that everybody who is doing TV journalism knows that somebody runs into the picture on the camera and pulls him back to get him out there. So thank you again, Alina. I hope to have you back maybe in the near future, and assignment that you have to do.
Pleasure. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your kind words.
Bye. So, I got to know Alina when she started to work in this field. She was a blogger, really. She had a good colleague and friend who was a Russian who did, he's doing excellent work in Germany. What he does really is he started out, originally his profession was repairing coffee machines. And I always joked to him and said, if I was on the US intelligence, the first person I would take out in the media situation in Germany would be you, because what he did is he simply translated German TV programs into Russian. And that was so successful in Russia. I think what people need to understand is that the level of education in the Soviet Union was very high. I noticed that when I drove through Russia, really from Berlin to Grozny in the Caucasus by car in 2017. And that was a lot of kilometers, but it was also a lot of nationalities. And that's what people don't know really about Russia, that Russia is a multi-ethnic country. And multi-ethnic means, for example, when we were going to the Kalmyk Republic, I think it's Kalmyk, it's Kalmykische in German, Kalmykische Republik, that is near the Caucasus. At the entrance to the country, you find a huge billboard, and it shows the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama is the spiritual head of the state. And it says in Cyrillic language, Om Mani Padme Hum. I couldn't believe what I saw. It was real, like a big advertisement along the road. And you go in there, and I'd been in Tibet doing a documentary, and we went into illegally, by the way, we went illegally into the Kashmir area, which is a military because of skirmishes there. We didn't. I wasn't there. I was there simply for it was a documentary on ancient culture about 1000 after Christ, before really the before the Buddhists came to Tibet. This is what we were shooting, but we were not allowed to be there because China considered it a dangerous area in connection to the conflict with India they have there. The border is there. Some killed soldiers over the decades in this area. And we've been there. And so I know really rural Tibet, which has a religion before Buddhism. And the religion before Buddhism is Burn. And that still existed in that area. So, and then when I went to the Kalmyk Republic, I couldn't believe my eyes because it looked like Tibet. And the people looked like in Tibet. And they even had the same very, very laid-back humor. So I noticed that their attitude, they weren't Russian. They were they were like Tibetan people in the monasteries there. And I never heard about that before. So I sent home photos and said, I'm on an assignment. Where am I? Yeah, and I sent photos from an old temple. There's even a new one, a huge thing, a huge Gelugpa temple there. So from the Yellow Hats, that's what they're called in Tibet, where the Dalai Lama, the one of the denominations, if you want to call it, of Buddhism, that he belongs to. And people thought I was somewhere in Tibet, yeah, but it was Russia. And then we went on and we were in the Caucasus, and I was in Grozny. And Grozny, people had warned me, even knowledgeable people warned me. They said it could be very dangerous, be careful what happens there, don't go out at night alone, and so on. And we were in Grozny, and I have to say it looked like Las Vegas. Not like I expected a partly destroyed city, but it had been rebuilt, by the way, with a lot of Russian money. And it was incredible how it looked like. And it was not a problem at all to walk around at night. We were soon interviewed by the local TV because Germans in Grozny was something unusual. So, and these were Muslims. Then we went to an area where they were breeding horses. And wherever I went, I noticed that you have these people from the Caucasus, which are very different. They are not Russian at all. If you go north, they are people who are rather indigenous, like the Inuit. They are not Russian at all. They are about 200 nationalities. And this is what you notice. And then I'd been in Dagestan, in the middle of nowhere. It was really the middle of nowhere. We were at a kolchosis where they had cows, and one of the guys taking care of the cows, he was about 60 years old and missing a lot of teeth, and he looked like, I'm sorry to say, but it's true, he looked like a bummer. And when we sat there, he said to me, you're talking so much, I'd like to have a question to you. And said, do you know about history? And I said, yes, a little bit. And do you know about the history of the Cold War? And I said, yeah, that's by accident. I would consider myself a specialist on that. And then he said, then please explain to me why especially you Germans think that the Americans have something good with you in mind as the only ones in the world. And I had to laugh because it was really a good question. This is exactly what happens now in Germany, that we have the strange case of the explosion of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And we have been told ridiculously that it was Russia which did it, or who did it. And of course, that's pure nonsense. The point was that Chancellor Scholz had been, he had been officially, it has been declared that he could that Nord Stream 2 would be shut down, that America would take care of that. That was said by the foreign minister, it was said by Victoria Nuland, it was said by the president himself in the presence of Scholz. So Scholz shut down Nord Stream 2 2 days before the war, himself. And that gave him the opportunity to open it up if he decided. And to make sure that this was no opportunity, I think it's fair to say that somebody from the West, maybe it was United States, maybe it was Great Britain, maybe Poland was involved. It could be a mix of all of that, maybe even Ukraine with some special operations people that were trained by the British. That's another possibility. But why should Russia shut down Nord Stream 2? The possibility to have influence on German policy. They could simply shut it down. They wouldn't have to destroy it. But from the American side, this has been a question since the 80s. In the 80s, there was already a treaty between Soviet Union and Germany that Soviet Union would deliver gas and oil, and Germany would first deliver the piping to do that, and then would pay something like $8 billion per year to the Soviet Union, and they got into a real conflict with the United States because of this contract. They even sent a delegation to the German bank to make sure that they wouldn't finance this deal. It was financed by Dresdner Bank and Deutsche Bank in Germany. And the American side there was a huge press campaign that they should refrain from that. And the arguments were the same as today, that they would get into dependency. But Germany did it under then Chancellor Schmidt, because it was known that the Soviets were strict to the millimeter in their dealings with Western countries with these contracts. They would never break anything. They were the most reliable partner you could have. So Germany had about 30% of its energy from Soviet Union. That was considered not a big danger. Under Merkel, it was 40% then. But we don't talk about that. We don't talk about, it's not an issue anymore in Germany, the explosion of the Nord Stream pipeline. And it's very strange. So this is, going back to Alina, that's I got to know her in connection with these journeys to Russia. And she was at that time simply just finished university, was looking what to do, and was a very open, very curious and brave young woman who was trying to find a good job. Her first idea was really to do something on what she studied. She's an environmentalist and environmentalist technique, and she was thinking about doing something in Crimea, because a lot of the technology in this field originates from Germany. It's a German industry stronghold, so to speak. And there was high interest in Russia, especially in Crimea, on that. And there's an old connection between Crimea and Germany, dating back several hundred years. So there are also Germans in Crimea. There are a lot of nations in Crimea. If you look at that, the Greek had been there, the Romans had been there, the Tatars had been there, the British had been there, the Turkish had been there. Crimea is a very important strategic place. So anybody who had ships and had the military was running over this place. And then, of course, in Second World War Germany. I get back to this point. So I got to know her via these visits of Russia and Crimea. And I see she's just an astonishing, very intelligent, very brave young woman. And now she's the enemy of the state in Germany. But for get back to the ads, I will keep on talking for the next time.
You should hear what Mike Ryan's talking about.
Now, whether you like him or not, or whether you believe he is guilty or not, those charges were thrown out at the end of the day, and it was evident that the carriage of injustice was purported on a man in Victoria. Cardinal Pell was found guilty twice, because I believe that the court system and the government was up to its old usual tricks. The same tricks the government has also implicated all Victorians on throughout COVID, the climate emergency, which is all lies, all BS. So Cardinal Pell found not guilty in the High Court of Australia. But we have the death of Cardinal Pell. Victorian Premier Dan Andrews, Pig of the Year, he is now not going to have a state memorial service. He's offered his support and sympathy to those abused by people in the Catholic Church. That is right. If you have been abused by any church, anyone that is abused, they need all of our sympathy. But the courts did not find George Pell guilty. The High Court did not.
Mike Ryan on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Wake up and text. Text and eat. Mm-mm. Text and catch the bus. Text and miss your stop.
Wait.
Text and be late to work.
Sorry, I'm late.
Text and work. Text and pretend to work. Text and act surprised when someone calls you out for not working.
Who, me?
Text and meet up with a friend you haven't seen in forever.
Hi.
Oh, hey.
Text and complain that they're on their phone the whole time. Text and listen to them complain that you're on your phone the whole time. Text and whatever. But when you get behind the wheel, give your phone to a passenger. Put it in the glove box. Just don't text and drive. Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Our brains control how we act in the world. But did you know the world around us also affects our brains? Our genes, environment, and social interactions all work together to shape the way our brains develop. Sometimes these factors combine in ways that create unhealthy thoughts or feelings. Over time, these unhealthy thoughts and feelings become so unmanageable that we need outside support to get better. 50% of people will develop at least one mental health condition during their lifetime, and half of those people will develop a mental health condition by age 14. Unfortunately, it takes about 10 years for people to get the treatment they need. We don't wait to treat health problems like heart disease or cancer until stage 4. We shouldn't wait to take care of our mental health. The right early treatment can change lives, reducing school dropout rates, hospitalization, incarceration, and unemployment. Imagine what the world would look like if we all got the help we needed when we first started showing the early warning signs. Start the conversation before stage 4. Visit mentalhealthamerica.net to get informed, take an online screening, and better understand your own mental health.
A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
Dirk Pohlman. On today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Yeah, my guest was Alina Lipp, who had to leave for a news assignment right now. So I take over and tell a little bit how I got to know her and about the situation. So when I came back from this journey, we were talking about that. And also I had been, as I said, in Grozny, and had a very interesting talk with a Sufi there, with a, so a Muslim, what do you call that, like a priest. And it was very, very heartwarming, because this man said, I asked him after the two Chechen wars, what he thought was most important for Grozny. And he said, what we need is those people, the foreigners that had been there, the people from other denominations. He was talking about Christians and Jews, basically. And he said, we're missing them. It's kind of a garden here, and there are important plants missing. So we noticed afterwards how much they were part of us. And it was, life wasn't bad there for any of these people. And he said, we would like to simply have them back. And he was telling me, and then I talked about that with Alina, that, you know, that's also not very well known in the West, that it was the gang around Cheney in the American government who made sure that the people who had been used as Mujahideen in Afghanistan then came into Chechnya. They had they wanted to have a caliphate, a caliphate there in Chechnya, and they had these terrorists, really, throat cutters, you can take that verbally, that came into Chechnya and were fueling the war. The problem was that they didn't speak Russian, they didn't speak one of the Caucasian languages there, they only spoke Arab. And so it was very difficult to communicate even for themselves with the people there. They were simply there as warlords, as guns for hire that did the job, because Chechnya, there was a pipeline intended to go through there, and that was the reason why they were used. And I talked to a former KGB agent, a former resident of the KGB in Great Britain once, who told me when the whole thing with the Arab terrorism was a big thing, most of the unemployed KGB agents called themselves specialists for terrorists at that time. And he said, well, you probably know that this is a German idea, a German invention of World War II, using all these people from the Caucasus, the Muslims, even some Buddhists, all the people who were not, who had been mistreated by Stalin and were moved around and suppressed. I mean, all religions were suppressed, but for these people who had a fierce sense of independence, it was unbearable. So he said the Germans, the Nazi Germans in World War II, the pragmatic side of the intelligence services used these Russians. And this is what the Americans, the whole idea, the whole structure was taken over by the Americans after World War II. I never heard that before. There's quite a lot of truth to that. It's also not well known, but this is what happened in Chechnya. So when I talked with Alina, we were discussing these things. I said there's a whole universe of things we don't know about Soviet Union and Russia, and it could be the work of a lifetime to tell the stories we never heard about, to get somewhat of a better understanding about this huge space, Russia, which is like 220, it's like, no, it's not. It's less than 200 million. It is like more like 120 million, I think, that we have now in Russia. So it's the biggest country in the world, but not the one with the highest amount of inhabitants. And that had always been, it's something like 140, I just looked it up, 140 million people there. And now there are plans from the American side. There's quite a lot of talk. There are even conferences that say they have to decolonize Russia, to split Russia up into six or seven states, to I call that Yugoslavization, that they want to make it that it's possible to handle this huge space, and they want to, first for that they have to bring Putin down. This is what is after what is behind the war in reality. At that time when I talked with Alina, we just noticed that things were strange. We noticed, as she explained, the deterioration of the conversations in Germany, that people were German-Russian. There were quite a lot, and we still had the laws that if you were of German origin, there were even people in the Soviet Union who couldn't speak Russian, that were still speaking German, that in very remote areas, but that existed. So if you were one of those ethnic Germans in Russia, you could immediately go to Germany and become a German citizen. That were laws from the Cold War. And of course, then after the Cold War, that meant that a lot of ethnic Russians, German Russians, would come into Germany. And she got to know quite a lot of these people. I got to know them when we had interviews and so on. So I noticed how Alina was shifting towards not being an engineer in environmental cases, and, for example, talking about water, all kinds of technical questions of water, which are very important in Crimea, which is dependent on the channel that comes from Ukraine, which the Ukrainians, by the way, immediately stopped after 2014. And it was a big problem. So she was going into journalism because that's what she encountered all the time, that she had the feeling that people don't understand what she heard from her father, from the relatives, from the Russians she got to know. And this is what all the other people that had good connections to Russia, I can say that there were some people who didn't like Putin, that's about a quarter of the population, and they were strong among the European correspondents and the Western correspondents, I would say, the attitude there. But we also had people that were Russia understanders, that is the good derogatory term that is used for them. And all of them, that I think needs to be understood, all of them in Germany, even foreign correspondents who'd been there for more than 10 years, like Gabriele Krone-Schmalz, she's very famous and she was in highest esteem as a specialized journalist, as a real good foreign correspondent. There were other people, Klaus Bettnartz was one of them. And they all, of course, had a different attitude because they said, this is too... it's too basic, too placard way of depicting Russia, what is done now in our media system. It's simply Russia bashing. And by doing that, you just have to mention that you think it's more complicated and it's more interesting. And we had opportunities. This is what Krone-Schmalz simply stated, and it's a fact that Putin came in the speech in 2000 in the German Bundestag in the parliament. He was explaining his wish to become so that we would become one Europe, that there would be negotiations and trade between our countries. And he was very positive, as Jacques Beau said in my first interview here on TNT, Russia contemplated to become a member of NATO. That was, they considered NATO a possibility to solve all military questions in good faith. So this was, their idea was, why can't Russia become a member of NATO? Because they didn't consider it a threat. They considered it a leftover from the Cold War, but one that could be used by all sides to their benefit. And this, it's really weird. If you're old enough and experience this time frame, and if you're European enough and experience this time frame, then you notice that things deteriorated not fast, but steadily. It became worse and worse. It started out with Winds of Change from the German group The Scorpions, a beautiful song about this Winds of Change, yeah, the attitude that prevailed at that time. And then, I think last year, they retracted that title and said they cannot play it and they don't want it anymore after the invasion of Ukraine through Russia. And all of that was not necessary. And we are ahead of something similar like that with China now. This is the ramp up, the same ramp up that we saw with Russia is happening with China now. And it's the same. It's not necessary. It's not inevitable. And if everybody talks about an unprovoked war that Russia started in Ukraine, that's, in a way, it's ridiculous. Yeah. So I was talking about that with Alina, and then she started to do reporting, and there were some mistakes that she had in her reporting. She was a little bit too fast in reporting what others had reported and what she noticed as news, not really news, not state distributed news or radio or TV distributed news, but news from private Telegram channels. And not all of that is true. And some of the things that she showed, for example, one case of a kindergarten in Ukraine that was shelled, and I think it turns out it was at least questionable. So she was not careful enough in some instances, but this is, you could see that she was brave. She went there. That is, as I said, what most correspondents don't do. Also, war correspondents don't do. She did that. She went there. And instead of seeing what I, as an old hand, saw, I saw a young, very intelligent, brave young woman who wanted to do reporting, who had an urge to do reporting. It was not to become a celebrity or an influencer or a well-known person. It was, she was there with a lot of energy in her soul. So she was somebody who needed some training, some journalistic training, who needed best to have somebody at her side who would be more experienced and a little cooler head. But that's about it. There was a lot of opportunity. She was from the side where you say the possibilities that she had were all the right ones. It would just need some polishing to get her to become a very important war correspondent. And what happened to her is that she was standing there reporting, and you could visualize it of getting big chunks of mud and feces into all over her, thrown at her. It was very unfair from the very beginning what happened to her. It was not looking with experience on her case and saying, okay, she's there. And this is why I asked her if anybody tried to get in contact with her. That is the strange case in Germany, that you cannot be on both sides. You cannot start out in the alternative media and then transfer to the mainstream media. Simply not possible. Whereas we discussed that, I discussed it with her in Crimea, and we had a conversation with two bloggers in Crimea. One was a Tatar, a guy from mixed martial arts, quite an animal, and very friendly guy who was doing a show on, had a Telegram channel with 700,000 subscribers on health issues. He was doing a kind of health training that only exists in some areas of Russia, or in Russia, and especially in Crimea, where it's very warm, it's tropical. In summertime, it's like southern France. You could compare it to southern France, and they were doing what you do in a fitness studio out in the woods. So they were running through a canyon uphill and lifting the stones that they were there, and doing push-ups and so on, and doing physical training, also weird stuff like running with your breath, keeping your breath for 1 minute and running, so you have kind of a lack of oxygen in your brain to get used to that. Strange stuff that we don't do. And then in the end, they would jump into the ice cold river coming from the mountain. So that was that's called health stash as a training. And we were looking at that together. We were in Crimea, and we noticed that the deterioration of the reporting from the Russian side at that time, I never met, really never. No, there was one exception in 2017, where I met a guy from the Night Wolves, a kind of motorcycle gang people, but not as Hell's Angels. They're rather accepted by the population, especially the women, really. Said when I asked some elderly woman about them, then they said, well, good-looking man. That was the comment on them. So they were not like feared like Hell's Angels or so. But that guy said, if you Germans ever come again and try the same as in World War II, and we are short of that now, nobody of you will be spared. It will not be like after the Second World War, where the Russians didn't take revenge for the 27 million killed Soviet citizens. That was a genocide. It was intentional. It was not casualties of war. It was trying to kill off people. Besides that, I never met anybody in Russia who was anti-German, or even... They were a bit wary about the American military, but they were always curious, and the attitude was always, we don't know enough of each other, and It's very easy to get invited there if they notice that you are a stranger. They're simply curious. It is a very positive reaction. That has changed now, I hear from Alina. And at that time, we thought we have to do something to make that known. That is so. This is when we had several interviews together where we talked about our common ancestry, the Green Party, that we both have been members of the Green Party, and we're astonished how this peacenik party turned into a belligerent and belligerent group. And right now in the German government, they are the strongest proponents of weapons delivery. And so we both had a different opinion. Originally, the Green Party came from the idea that NATO and NATO and Warsaw Pact should be abandoned. They even wanted all intelligence services to be abandoned, and they were strictly pacifistic at that time. And you could discuss that, but they are the opposite now. It's very weird. So we discussed that. And then I noticed that there started to be reports, and people tried to do reports on her. And sometimes I got a call from her, and he said, should I do it? And I listened to what was going on, and I thought, no, you shouldn't. I told her that I think it would end badly, but she was good-willed and young-hearted enough to not listen to me. And she did it, and time after time, on several occasions, she encountered this, the bad faith of people who tried to talk her into, we are really interested in you. And I met others from the German-Russian population here who were interviewed, and there was even there was a documentary that was shot, and they asked me to be part of that because I knew one of the German-Russian guys, Sergei Filbert, who has this this channel Golos Germani, which is translating, as I said, and he translated, to give you an idea, the most popular program from Germany was a satirical, as a comedy thing, maybe comparable to, in a rough way, to Jon Stewart or maybe Jimmy Dore from The Style. It was very political, very funny, very intelligent, very informative also. And that was the most popular program that he translated. And so they said they were interested in him because of this program. And I said, yeah, okay, then if it's about this avenue, I investigated a little bit who was the guy doing that. And we knew each other from work together in one of the TV production companies that worked for the German public TV system, for which I had worked 30 years. And a guy told me he's okay. So I think he's not a Russia-hating person, and it will be, probably is okay. I don't know what they're going after, but so I reluctantly said, okay, I go along and do it. And it turned out that this is now in Wikipedia about me, that I gave a speech where I was asked to give a speech at an Easter demonstration. These are the peace demonstrations in Europe on Easter, where I talked about the whole situation worldwide and noticed that NATO is not a force of peace and that it's kind of a business-operated thing. That's what Julian Assange had said, for example, about Afghanistan, that the war in Afghanistan was never supposed to end, but it was a money-making scheme that they wanted to go on for a long time. And that was the only thing from the whole lecture into that, and that went into the documentary, and all the people in the documentary were smeared. And so in my Wikipedia entry, they deleted the The prizes I got for films and the nominations I got for TV awards and the positive comments I had in mainstream media for my documentaries, and all of that was deleted and this was put in. So I noticed, and then from that, that was the last time I trusted anybody from that side. But Alina went on to think it's possible that people simply want to report, because she felt she was like, I'm good-willed, so they will notice it from after some time when they talk to me. But this is what's wrong with our mainstream media, at least in Germany, but I think worldwide, that you cannot rely that somebody comes and says, I want to have a fresh look at you. And they cannot, because in the editorial, in the editorial conferences that they will encounter, this attitude is not acceptable. Back to me and after the ads.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
So how low can Joe Biden's son Hunter go? Well, you might have seen some of the unflattering and some might say downright sick, twisted, perverted pictures that have been posted from his famous laptop. You know, the one that was Russian disinformation. And there's the child that he fathered with London Roberts, a former Arkansas stripper who was working at a club in D.C. around the same time Hunter was dating his older brother's widow. The New York Post says Biden initially denied having sex with Roberts, and a DNA test confirmed he's the father. And nice guy Hunter has recently sought to lower his child support payments. Now, Navy Joan Roberts is 4 years old, and her mother wants her to take Hunter Biden's surname. The Post says Hunter Biden asked a judge to deny that request, claiming the name is a lightning rod for criticism and would rob the child of a peaceful coexistence. Roberts, the mom, says it would benefit their daughter because Biden is now synonymous with being well-educated, successful, financially acute, and politically powerful. I don't know about that, but I sure hope the judge does the right thing and gives this little girl the Biden name, especially if Hunter doesn't want her to have it. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Here's that song again. Yay! Here's that song again.
For the 100th time today.
Here's that song again.
It's gonna be stuck in your head all day.
Yay! Here's that song again. It will make you cray cray.
You love your kids enough to watch that TV show a bajillion times. Yay! Love them enough to make sure they're in the right car seat for their age and size. Show them you love them. Keep them safe. Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
When a child is sick, there's one thing they need. A really big cookie.
Welcome to RMHC.
And parents of sick children have tons of decisions to make. Like movie night, game night, or should we finish that book tonight? We don't perform surgeries, just talent shows. We're not big on poking sticks and beeping machines, but we're the best at playing dress up. Well, we have a few beeping machines. We think the tooth fairy should travel everywhere. And while hospitals have doctors and nurses, we have mom and dad. We don't provide treatment, but we do provide dogs. And we throw some really good parties. Because at Ronald McDonald House Charities,
we are home.
We help families feel at home, even when they can't be. Donate today at rmhc.org/donate.
A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
So Davos is wrapping up today, which means beware. All those planes are going to be flying out of there, putting more CO2 into the air, and the weather is just about to go crazy all over the place. In fact, the weather is going kind of crazy all over the place, crazy cold. You might think it was wintertime or something. From the Middle East, specifically Iraq and Iran, all the way over to the Far East, it is wickedly cold. That is a huge area that's cold. Western Europe is cold. And we also have the United States getting cold and stormy. What's going on here? Well, it's wintertime. And of course, we've had Al Gore unhinged, John Kerry call himself an extraterrestrial, apparently losing to Bush causes a problem with them. And then there's Greta getting arrested for protesting coal plants in Germany, where it's cold. Well, it's cold in China too. Maybe she should go and protest the coal plants they're building over there. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
This is the Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Yeah, Dirk Pohlman, and I had the guest Alina Lipp, who is now under state prosecution in Germany for what is called helping a war of aggression that is threatened by 3 years in jail. And she got that from reporting from the Donbas. And she was on the spot walking around there and giving quite extraordinary under shelling sometimes. She was doing reports directly from the spot, and she did what a foreign correspondent was supposed to do. And she's clearly... for the Russian side, her position is not from the Ukrainian government, from the Russian side, but to declare that criminal is something that I consider, I don't know, I don't, this is not my country, my system anymore. We were talking about that, and I warned her of these interview requests that she got, because they were... If you would check the people who would do it, and I got them, as I mentioned, I was interviewed for a documentary where, against my belly feeling, I trusted the colleague whom I knew to do a decent job, but he didn't. And so I was tried to be depicted of being in the vicinity of these Putin agents. They have refrained for the last months to put me into that perspective. I don't know really why, because others have been. As I said, my esteemed colleague Patrick Barb, an excellent specialist on the Iran-Contra affair and the German connections to that, which is the Barshal murder. I don't go into that now. It was hard to understand, but it means that we have a crisis of journalism, that Alina Lipp is not seen as an asset, but as something that needs to be destroyed. It's the whole thing developed into a situation where you only are friend or foe. And as a journalist, you shouldn't be either. You should be the one who is running around with a white flag between the trenches. Your place is between your seating between the chairs. You should always be. And if you have somebody like Alina Lipp, and there have been 5 reports about how bad she is as a person, and you talk to her, your task as a journalist is really to listen as freshly to it and get your own impression and divert, to have kind of a pluralistic possibility. If you notice that everyone is reporting the same, it could be because it's true, but it also could be a big mistake. And I think the listeners who listen to Alina Lipp can understand that she's not doing what she does because she's a shrewd, Putin-trained, KGB-trained, FSB-trained foreign influence agent, but she's a young woman, and she's hurt now by what she experienced. And instead of having the foreign correspondents, we need foreign correspondents. And there's even a bigger problem than with Russia, which is still part of the, let's say, philosophically, the Western rationalist empire of thought. We have the China, which is so different from us that you need translators, you need foreign correspondents, and it's not enough if you're simply out there. I think you have to have background knowledge and the ability and the willingness to deal with a completely different system of thought, to understand what's going on there and to explain it. And it's, again, like with the Russian situation, it's depicted simply as a friend or foe, and they're declared foe now. And the same thing, the same ramp up that we had with Russia, which was completely unnecessary. I repeat, I think I can judge that from my experience, what I encountered. The Russia was eager after the end of the Cold War to live in peace. It was not the intention of the Russian side to have a Soviet empire back or whatever I hear there. It was very different. It was always trying to get into conversation and into dealings and into a collaborative existence and have something like Eurasian common market. That was the idea of Gorbachev. It was the idea of Putin. He was talking from Lisbon to Vladivostok about that, and that's not what the Anglo-Saxon Empire since more than 100 years wanted. Their nightmare was Germany and Russia being together and working together, and that could mean something very different. This is also what Brzezinski wrote about in his book, the only remaining superpower, or that his book on geostrategy. So this is what we would need. Would be people in journalism that explain to us what the attitude is. We would need people that explain to us what the attitude of the population is. And we have now the very strange situation in Germany that our military top people, especially if they are in retirement, the people who are in retirement and had been the advisors to Angela Merkel or had been chief of the German forces, they urge us to be careful and to know that we need an exit strategy, and this conflict will need a diplomatic solution. There will be no military solution, and that it's dangerous, and that it's no way to treat the strongest nuclear power, which Russia still is, in terms of the amount of warheads. They have slightly more than the United States. Both are about 7,000 warheads. And our military top people urge us, who are not in effect in NATO right now, urge us to be more careful, to be more reluctant, to show that that we don't want to head towards a World War III, which is a possibility. General Vlad, the former advisor to Angela Merkel, even said in an article that couldn't be published in our mainstream media, he had to divert to a feministic magazine. Can you imagine that? Which chief editor had written a letter where she asked for negotiations and to stop this war. So the old green position, so to speak. So he told that we need to take this into account, that we need to negotiations, that World War III is there. And he even compared it to Verdun. He compared the situation in Ukraine, where you have this, where each day hundreds of soldiers die, and it's not, there's not much movement. It's not heading towards a decision, even if we are told in our media that it's heading towards a decision. And this is so, the military people are standing on the brake and are reluctant, whereas the politicians, most of the politicians, are in favor of fueling this conflict and trying to have a regime change in Moscow, which will be dangerous. You won't treat a nuclear power like a bad boy, like giving him some slaps on the wrist and on the cheeks, so he will behave again. That's not a possibility. So we are in that. And I discussed with Alina. I would like to have a story on this encounter with a Danish journalist and the German magazine for which I'm chief editor, because I think it's like a theater play, where you can learn something as an ideal, typical situation that you can watch. What happened to journalism in our country, and I think not only in our country. So we need more of this foreign correspondence that, like Alina is, and we don't get them. So I'd like to see. I will have another interview with her about the situation, because this transition from a well-meaning, intelligent young lady to the devil in disguise, who needs to be prosecuted before she can transfer her terrorist intentions to the media system in Germany, is ridiculous. And it's only a depiction of what is wrong with our media system. So, sorry for this long talk from my side, but it was necessary because Alina had the assignment, and I hope to hear from her what her assignment was, what it looked like.